It's Here and Now. President Bush has signed into law a major shift in U.S. nuclear policy. The law allows American companies to sell nuclear materials and technology to India. Critics say, though, the U.S. is barred from doing such business with India because India never signed a nuclear non-proliferation treaty, and it's already tested two nuclear weapons. India's nuclear program is listed as number one on the top 10 missed stories of the year in Foreign Policy magazine. And joining us on the line from Washington is Will Dobson. He's managing editor for the magazine. Hi, Will.
Hi, thanks for having me.
India's nuclear program makes the number one spot on your missed story list. Why is that?
Well, there's been a lot of attention ever since the deal first was negotiated, but there have been some details that have surrounded the deal that have missed the attention that they probably deserve. And so it was some of those details that landed it in the number one story that you missed in 2006.
So give me some of the details that you think we've overlooked.
Sure. Well, there's been a lot of concern, as you just indicated, about what it would mean for the U.S.-Indian nuclear deal to lift the U.S. moratorium on nuclear trade with India. And a lot of that concern has to do with U.S. nonproliferation policy in general and the chance that regimes would get weapons or the parts to weapons even that would make the world much less safe. Iran is the principal one, North Korea too. Although India, and this is where we get to the India nuclear deal, India has longstanding ties with Iran. So if you go back to July, when the U.S. House of Representatives first voted to support the plan to provide India with nuclear technology, it was after the vote that the Bush administration quietly imposed sanctions on two Indian firms for supplying Tehran with missile parts. Now, this is something that you just have not heard much attention at all in the media in this past year, and we think it's something that probably members of Congress would have liked to have known before they cast their votes back in July.
Mm-hmm. So why don't you explain to us a little bit about what does each side get from this
Sure.
deal?
Well, backers of the deal will say at least now you're going to get some inspections of the civilian nuclear program in India. That's something that we didn't have before. Also, and this is an important one, U.S. firms stand to benefit handsomely from this nuclear trade with India.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what does India get?
Well, on the flip side, for India, they now are going to be able to participate in a trade that's going to be very beneficial to one of their chief problems going forward as a booming economy, and that's energy supply. Now, again, critics would quickly say, wait a minute, India could use this imported nuclear fuel to feed its civilian program and then divert its own nuclear fuel to build more bombs. The question is, will they or won't they?
Right. Because this deal, we should say, when we talk about inspections, the deal calls for inspections of the civilian nuclear energy program in India, but not the military program. Is there any crossover there? Do we know how it's divided?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is one big area of concern. I mean, the law will allow civilian nuclear trade between the two countries, and in exchange, Indian safeguards inspections at 14 of its civilian nuclear plants. But 8 military plants will remain off-limit to inspectors.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean for the region, do you think, in terms of any kind of a nuclear arms race? I mean, there have been concerns from some who said that the U.S. is basically doing this as a counterweight to China. Obviously, the U.S. has denied that and has said that the deal actually sort of strengthens worldwide nonproliferation efforts. What do you think it means for the region to have this agreement between the U.S. and India?
It's really difficult to say whether or not it's going to start an arms race or not. Many people say this is a race that's already begun. And if it shifts support to such a degree in India's favor, then you should expect in return a renewed partnership, a continued strengthened partnership between China and Pakistan, which have historically assisted each other with their own nuclear program. So I don't know that you really should see it, though, spreading beyond those players who have been locked in this race for now many decades.
Mm. And as you mentioned briefly, even though President Bush signed it today, it's not completely final yet.
Right. There are other bodies that have to weigh in particular the IAEA.
Will Dobson is managing editor of Foreign Policy magazine. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is continuing his push for early elections despite the intensified fighting between his Fatah party and Hamas, which controls parliament and the cabinet, and which says early elections are an attempt to topple its government. President Abbas today also said he's ready to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert anytime, and Abbas is asking the international community to help restart peace talks. There are those who are trying to find other ways of communicating across the divides in the Middle East. What you're hearing is the West Eastern Divan Orchestra under the baton of Daniel Barenboim. They're performing Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante in E-flat major. The musicians come from across the Middle East, from Israel, Syria, and Lebanon. Barenboim is an Argentinian-born Israeli who's been a long vocal critic of Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Barenboim and his orchestra have performed in Berlin, in Ramallah in the West Bank, and tonight they'll be playing at the United Nations in a concert to honor retiring Secretary General Kofi Annan. We spoke with Maestro Barenboim when he came to Brown University this past weekend for a series of workshops and a performance, but there was one thing he wanted to make clear from the beginning about the West Eastern Divan Orchestra.
It's not a political project. And when I say that, people always sort of smile benevolently, you know, because how can you bring together Palestinians, Israelis, Syrians, and Lebanese, you know, at a time when countries refuse to talk to one another and claim that it's not political. But it isn't. It was a program that was based on the one political, if you want, conclusion, namely that there is no military solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Once you accept that, then you have to get to know each other. You have to understand what are the wishes, the necessities, the narrative of the other. And I say that for both sides.
Was it ever really difficult for your players to communicate their beliefs to each other, to get
beyond
the music?
Don't forget that when somebody comes from Damascus and somebody comes from Tel Aviv, they represent the menace, the enemy, for the other. And therefore, it takes time, and it took time, and sometimes it takes a lot of patience and a lot of understanding, and it doesn't always come. But it's not only that we play music. It's the way we play music, the way we rehearse. You know, the most wonderful thing about music is not that it allows you to forget the world, but from music you can also learn so much. And I think this is, in a way, as important, if not more important. And what you learn from music is that if you want to play intelligently in an orchestra, you have to play creatively. You have to really express all that you think and feel about the music. At the very same time, you have to listen to what the other is playing. I mean, what better school for understanding do you want?
Musicians in your orchestra are very young, obviously many of them look at each other or have been raised up until this point to look at the other as enemy. They've been brought up, some of them, with hatred. Can you tell me if you feel that their collaboration in the music has been able to transcend some of that, and how?
I don't think that anybody who has been through this has remained the same. It has changed everybody's life, the way they think of each other. You know, today we just arrived now in Boston from Europe, and you should have seen the joy and affection with which some of the Arabs and Israelis greeted each other. You know, this goes far beyond what is expected of people playing an orchestra. In other words, there have been friendships, if you want, created, not in the sense that they email daily to each other, although I'm sure some of them do, but that when they come together, it is something very special, and it means a lot to them.
You've made made a number of journeys into Ramallah, and you've worked with musicians there. Can you talk about what that has taught you as an Israeli?
Well, it has taught me, first of all, much more than an Israeli, it's taught me that music is really absolutely universal and much less dependent on the sort of tradition of years and years of living in a musical center. When you see some of these Palestinian children, how not only excited they get about the music, but how very talented they are and how quickly they make progress. It is a fantastic thing to watch as a musician. As an Israeli, it teaches me that, unfortunately, on the ground, things are not as possible as they are with the music, because the music gives everybody an equality which they don't have on the ground. You know, whatever you think about the situation, whatever the political angle is that you come from, it is a fact that Israel has occupied large parts of the West Bank since 1967, there for nearly 40 years. This is a fact, and therefore they are not equals. But when they play music, they are equals. What has this whole experience of the last 7 years has taught me that music really has the ability to give us the instruments to forget the world and at the same time give us the instrument to understand the world much better. But for this, it is absolutely imperative that one really learns to think about music as something more than a collection of sounds. You have to play with brain, with heart, and with stomach, you know, with rationality, with emotion, and with temperament. And you cannot have one and not the other and all these things. And therefore, if you learn to think about all these elements of music making, of what dialogue is, of how when you play in chamber music, one instrument has the main voice and the other instruments go with it and follow it, and a few bars later it's finished and the main voice goes somewhere else, and therefore the person playing that main voice is not anymore the leader of the group. You learn from that also how life is really constructed amongst human beings.
Conductor Daniel Barenboim, his West Eastern Divan Orchestra is performing at the UN today. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. And now, we're continuing our conversation with Daniel Barenboim, a conductor and classical pianist who also is no stranger to politics. Barenboim is an Argentinian-born Israeli, and he leads an orchestra made up of musicians from across the Middle East. His trombone section reportedly is made up of an Israeli Jew, a Palestinian Muslim, and a Spanish Roman Catholic. He co-founded the West Eastern Divan Orchestra with the late Palestinian-American scholar Edward Said, and he's been a longtime critic of Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. I asked Barenboim to respond to people who have criticized him for making music with musicians from countries considered enemies of Israel.
Let's face it, the lines of the Israeli government of dealing with the Palestinians has not been successful. We are living in this conflict for 60 years. And therefore, I think rationality and logic teaches us that if you try something for so long it doesn't work, then you have to ask yourself some questions whether this is the right way or whether there must not be a change in the way you deal with the problem.
You've said that this orchestra is not political. You're performing at the UN, though, very soon. Is performing there, couldn't that be perceived as making a political statement?
Yeah, I told you at the beginning, the only political statement that we make is that we don't believe in a military solution. And this is why the United Nations is absolutely the appropriate place to go. And the outgoing Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, has spent so much of his time, talent, and energy dealing with the Middle Eastern conflict. And I think, if I'm not wrong, that ours is the only institution, the only project that includes all the parties from the Middle East, and therefore it is a very appropriate occasion to do that.
When you're choosing the repertoire for your concerts, some of the ones that I've listened to, it's been predominantly Beethoven and Bach and Tchaikovsky. Why do you, or how do you, select the music?
You must understand that there are some members of this orchestra that are, in the meantime, very accomplished musicians, but others, of course, not really. And, you know, and many of these people who come and are extremely talented need really basic education. And for that, I've always tried to find pieces that when they learn something valuable for every piece of music that they will play. I believe if you learn to play the Beethoven Ninth, which we played last summer, then you learn from that for everything else you play.
Could you or would you choose music by Israeli or Arab composers, or would you try to stay away from doing something like that?
I think that this is at the moment completely unnecessary. This would be just a way of satisfying a sentimental way of attaching. I don't think that this is the purpose of this.
Hmm. When you described your musicians and their friendships with each other, do you think that they, because of this experience, which is a relatively young experience, only been 7 years, do you think that they've been able to take that experience and broaden it out to society and transcend their differences because of their musical experience?
I think some of them have, others have not, but some of them certainly have. They look at the other in a completely different way.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I have to say, no matter how curious or how intelligent or how much they learn from the experience, all of them demonstrate a tremendous amount of courage to come and continue participating in this kind of a project. Courage because they have to overcome whatever inhibitions or whatever education they may have had. Courage because of the way they are looked at by their families and their societies, not always benevolently. And therefore that they come and do that fills me with great joy, of course, but also with great admiration for the courage that they have and they show every year. Look, this last summer was not easy. There was a terrible, stupid, cruel war between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. We have Lebanese members. We have other Arabs who feel for them. We have Israelis who feel for the families who live in northern Israel. And yet most of them, the great, great majority, came. And in spite of the war going on, in spite of the difficulties, not one person left the ship, as it were.
I have one last question for you. I read recently that you may be the choice to be the next musical director of the New York Philharmonic. Is that anything you would consider?
Nothing is further from my mind at the moment than taking up another position in the United States, a permanent position in the United States.
But flattering.
Very flattering. I felt very happy and very flattered. It's filled me with a lot of joy. But as I said, you know, I left Chicago Symphony last June, not in order to eventually take another permanent position in the United States.
We've been speaking with conductor Daniel Barenboim, who co-founded the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, which is performing at the United Nations in honor of retiring Secretary General Kofi Annan today. You're listening to the orchestra's Berlin performance of Beethoven's Ode to Joy. Tomorrow, the orchestra debuts at Carnegie Hall. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR.
It's Here and Now. An American Navy veteran from Chicago went to work in Iraq as a security contractor, but wound up spending 97 days in the U.S. military's maximum security detention center in Baghdad. 29-year-old Donald Vance says he was never allowed to see a lawyer and faced conditions that sound a lot like what we're hearing from the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba. Vance worked for a private company in Baghdad that was protecting American firms, but Vance suspected that his company was selling weapons to people linked to Iraqi militias. So he began feeding information to the FBI. After the U.S. military raided the company, Vance and another American were taken to the Camp Cropper Detention Center. New York Times reporter Michael Moss wrote about their experiences as part of his series, Law and Disorder, which examines law enforcement and legal issues in Iraq. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Amazing story.
Thanks very much.
It's very startling because Donald Vance and the other American detained, it appears that even though they were Americans, they were treated the way non-Americans would be treated if they were detained in Baghdad. Can you describe what happened to them, what the conditions were like while they were in detention in Baghdad?
They describe sort of a daily routine of being in their cells. The cells were 9 feet by 9 feet, had a concrete platform that they slept on with a thin mat, no sink, irregular sort of showering, basically in isolation. Once a day, they were, at least during the initial week or two starting, they were brought out for questioning, handcuffed, blindfolded, placed in wheelchairs, taken to a padded room with carpeting on the walls and the ceilings, and interviewed and questioned for 1, 2, sometimes more hours, and then returned to their cells. One of the larger sort of hardships they say in the cells is that the fluorescent lights, these 2 4-foot tubes in the ceiling in their cells, were never turned off at night. The military says it's their policy to turn them off at night. But both gentlemen who I interviewed said no, indeed, or their entire stay, the lights were kept on. Periodically during the night, they were rousted from their sleep and made to stand in the middle of the cell for inspection.
Can you tell us how Mr. Vance and the other American, Nathan Ertel, ended up in Camp Cropper?
They had been working for an Iraqi-based security company and had become increasingly alarmed about things they saw at the company. One was its amassing of several large caches of weapons and a steady stream of suspicious characters coming through and buying the weapons, including officials with the Ministry of Interior, which they know and were told by others have ties to and had ties at the time to militants and or even death squads. They also saw an employee of the company engaged in what's commonly being called in Iraq a beer for bullets program. They were trading, they were giving alcohol to American soldiers in return for ammunition that people at the company would use and or repairs on their weapons. Mr. Vance especially had struck up a relationship with an FBI agent in Chicago. He was an informant, and basically he was sending on to them every little thing that he thought the government would be interested in that looked suspicious to him, yes.
I'm sure a lot of people are listening thinking, okay, a guy who's an FBI informant gets taken into this detention facility, is there for months. How could that have happened?
When he was picked up, and what happened when he was at the compound, again, both gentlemen are feeling increasingly concerned for their own personal safety. One of them had actually tried to resign the company, and then company officials took their identification badges, which they need to travel around Iraq or leave the country. They called the U.S. Embassy for help, saying, come get us, we're hostages. The military sends in a rescue squad, and when the rescue squad arrives, Mr. Vance and Mr. Earl tell them, look for the arms caches. But instead of sort of taking them in and listening to their story as whistleblowers, you know, mysteriously, overnight, they become suspects. They were being accused of doing what they, in fact, had blown the whistle on.
Did they ever give him a lawyer? Were they ever able to contact their families?
The military rules are that you are not allowed to contact a lawyer until after you receive an initial hearing, which was approximately about a week into their time. At that hearing, because they're American citizens, and this is not true of Iraqi detainees, the thousands of Iraqi detainees who are being held in these facilities do not have the right to even attend their proceedings. In this case, these two gentlemen, it's a dual standard, being American citizens, were allowed to at least attend themselves. But the rules are that you shall not have legal representation.
And what does the U.S. military say about trying to reach the FBI and say, you know, yes, he may have had suspicions about these very things that you're accusing him of, but he was actually informing us. I mean,
the American military officials who run the detention operations acknowledge that he told them from the beginning that he was passing information on to the FBI, was an informant. They knew the name of his agent in Chicago, and they say that they did not telephone that agent into Chicago until 2 weeks after his hearing, which is now 3 weeks into his detention, that when they called that agent, he in fact did confirm that Mr. Vance was an informant. And yet he was continued to be held for the rest of the 97 days.
You know, I'm sure that there will be people who hear this and they think, well, you know, the U.S. may have had a good reason to hold Mr. Vance and Mr. Ertl. I mean, there must have been some sort of risk to U.S. security here, and it needed to be straightened out.
His point is that, you know, even if that's true, and he's speaking generally now because he denies having done anything wrong that should have drawn their attention, he was never charged, he was never told what he's being accused of, he was never allowed the right to have a legal defense to defend himself, and ultimately he was let go after this ordeal without being told why and why he was being let go, except, you know, being taken to the airport and a goodbye.
And Mr. Ertl, the other contractor, he was released earlier than Mr. Vance, but he's returned to Iraq.
He has, yes, for employment reasons. He's a contract manager. He had spent a couple of years in Iraq, and there is work to be done there, and important work. Both gentlemen actually had worked for contractors who were working on the free democratic elections in Iraq in 2004, and now they're working for people, you know, rebuilding the country. I mean, both of them say they love the work that they were doing and felt it was important. And Mr. Ertl, yes, is back in Baghdad working once more.
And Mr. Vance, though, is back in Chicago.
He's back home in Chicago, basically trying to put his life together. It was a more tormenting ordeal for him, and he's struggling emotionally and physically to deal with that.
Michael Moss, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Michael Moss is a reporter for the New York Times. He spoke to us about his series Law and Disorder, which today focused on the experiences of two American contractors who were held by U.S. forces in Iraq. You're listening to Here and Now. Christmas is just a week away, and whatever the day once was, for many people, it's now more marketing marvel than messianic miracle. Every year, commentator Nikki Tundell promises to avoid the holiday season. She's convinced even the red and green traffic lights are in on what she calls the conspiracy of Christmas time.
I try to hold the holiday season at arm's length. While others are diving into the Hickory Farms cheese logs and downing the egg-based beverages, I'm trying to dodge anyone sporting a Santa print turtleneck. I simply don't know how to have conversations with people who refer to our landscape of exhaust-tinged snow as a winter wonderland. But despite my efforts to avoid the advent, I can't seem to stay clear of Christmas. Say I want a simple, non-fat white chocolate mocha with extra whip. I have no choice but to order it from a barista donning felt reindeer antlers. And it's impossible to dash into Walgreens for some Nestle Quick and the latest Us Weekly without being serenaded by an electronic K. Kringle.
I go, ho, ho, in my new sleigh. I just can't sit. Gotta continue with it.
Then there's the anxiety and confusion. I never know if I should wish people Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays, or simply tell them to have a good weekend. And I have no idea if the neighbors are trying to be ironic when they put that inflatable Scooby-Doo in the stocking cap next to the plastic baby Jesus in their yard display. Some people say the Son of God is lost in the chaos of Christmas time. But if you ask me, Jesus clearly has a hand in the holiday. No one short of a miracle worker could get people to buy cranberry-scented body butter or NASCAR tree ornaments or Swarovski crystal in the shape of reindeer. Of course, if the Christ Child temporary tattoos and the We Three Kings shot glasses are any indication, perhaps there's some truth to the argument that Christmas has become a bit commercial. Still, I'm less troubled by the nativity scene navel rings than I am by the state of the seasonal soundtrack. Who decided a virgin birth would be best commemorated by the sound of cats belting out O Little Town of Bethlehem? I really want to hate Christmas time, yet no matter how hard I try to cultivate my inner cynic, something about the season always gets me. Some may say it's the holiday cheer. Others might credit the Holy Spirit. Dr. Seuss would probably extol bingo balls and hoo-foo fluff. All I know is that when the piano player at Macy's decides to perform Green Onions instead of a traditional holiday tune, I feel betrayed. The way I see it, when you're surrounded by poinsettias, R&B should be off limits. Sure, I think it's odd that people deck the halls with Uncle Sam nutcrackers and trim their trees with little bottles of Jack Daniels. But do I really want a world with no wreath-shaped pasta or Frosty the Snowman boxer briefs? I don't think so. I know Christmas Oreos are the same old sandwich cookies available year-round, but somehow they do taste better when the cream filling is red. Plus, truth be told, I'm a sucker for the little drummer boy. Who cares if historians say Jesus wasn't even born in December? Or that the manger wasn't decorated with tinsel-coated evergreens. On cold nights, it's just kind of nice to imagine a newborn baby surrounded by his parents, some sheep, a few angels, and a sweet little kid playing his heart out on the drum. It's easy to focus in on the absurdity of the holiday season, especially when some part-time employee in an elf costume suggests a loofah would make the perfect stocking stuffer for my sister.
I'm offering this simple prayer.
Yet I just can't deny the beauty of Christmas, especially when the Salvation Army bell ringer, a man with few teeth and a big smile, tells me that singing carols for shoppers is the highlight of his year.
Merry Christmas.
And you know what? I believe him.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas to you.
Commentator Nikki Tundell comes to us courtesy of the Minnesota Public Radio program, In the Loop. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Entertainment Weekly is calling it a serious contender for an Oscar nomination. And last week, New York and Washington, D.C. film boards gave it their award for Best Picture of the Year. But when United 93, Hollywood's first major feature film about 9/11, opened, there were concerns that it might have been made too soon. In fact, United 93's trailer was pulled from some theaters because it was upsetting patrons. United 93 looks at the events of that September morning through the eyes of air traffic controllers, the FAA, the military, and the passengers who attempted to overtake the plane from hijackers before it crashed in a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Here and Now's Renee Graham spoke with United 93's director and writer Paul Greengrass shortly before the film opened and asked him why he chose to make United 93 at that time.
I think all of us, although we don't agree with where we go from here, obviously, in your country or mine or in Europe, I think we all agree that it goes back to those 2 hours on the morning of September the 11th. And although it's often said never forget, I wonder how closely we really do look at those 2 hours. Why do I think that? Well, I'll give you a for instance. I think if you were to do a poll, I think you would find staggering numbers of Americans today believe that United 93 was shot down by the military, and that was has subsequently been covered up. I mean, you've only got to look at the internet to see the strength and the depth of that conspiracy theory. And obviously it's not true. I mean, the reality is that the military didn't even know about United 93 until 4 minutes after it had crashed, and there wasn't a fighter jet within 100 miles. But the fact that that conspiracy theory is so deep and broadly felt in this country and abroad indicates to me that we really need to look at the facts of the matter. I mean, and if you look at the events of 9/11, what you see, of course, is that we went to war in the space of 2 hours against an enemy we never saw, we didn't understand at all, and in a state of great confusion. And that should give us pause, I think, moving forward from here.
With your excellent film, Bloody Sunday, which was about the 1972 killings of demonstrators by British troops in Northern Ireland, that was made 30 years after the incident took place. Mm-hmm. 9/11 was less than 5 years ago. How do you respond to people who say it's just too soon for this film?
You know, I understand that to a certain extent, but this is a mature democracy here. And the issues of 9/11 and what we do today in the light of 9/11 are important to each and every one of us. And so whilst there will be some people who won't want to go and see this film, and I understand that, you know, it's painful and difficult, I think there will be a large number of people who take the view that it will be instructive and helpful to go back. And let's face it, there's been a debate in your country going on non-stop. A passionate discussion has been going on about what 9/11 means, what we can or should or shouldn't do in the light of 9/11. And surely now it's time that filmmakers should be allowed to join that conversation.
Let's listen to a scene from the film where the passengers aboard Flight 93 decide to take action and take over the plane.
They are not going to take us back to the airport.
Is there any other option we have?
We're going to die. We're going to die. They're flying this into a building. We're going to die.
You should not interfere.
There's a lot of us, but we got to do something. You see how low we are?
Is there a weapon? Is there something you can use? Go back. You go back. Stewardess, listen to me. Are you listening?
I'm listening.
Go back, and you get everything you can. Get every weapon you can.
Unlike, say, the sinking of the Titanic or the bombing of Pearl Harbor, there were no survivors from Flight 93 to provide eyewitness accounts. At what point does your film go from facts, such as phone calls between passengers and loved ones, to conjecture?
Of course, we can't know every single detail of what happened aboard United 93, but we can know a tremendous amount of what happened, obviously, from the large number of phone calls, also from the cockpit voice recorder, 30 minutes of that.
So you had access to the cockpit?
Access to people who'd listened to it, yeah. Now, there's the 9/11 Commission report, of course, which gives a very concise and detailed examination of what happened aboard United 93. Then moving on from there, you've got the way this film was made. We made this film collectively. Firstly with the families, all 40 families who approved this film and worked with us. But then more broadly, a lot of the people in this film were there on the day in the air traffic control rooms, in the National Command Center, people like Ben Sliney, who was in charge of the civil aviation system.
Who plays himself.
And I don't want a board full of these planes hitting every building on the East Coast. This is a national emergency. Everyone lands regardless of destination.
That's going to cost billions.
Just do it.
We have hundreds of international flights coming in. They're already in the air.
No, I don't want any more international flights crossing the borders. They're going to have to go back where they came from. Nobody's coming into the country from now on.
Everyone,
shut off the East Coast. Shut off all the international from Europe. Shut off South America. Shut off the West Coast. Nothing over the top either. Canada too.
Shut down the airspace.
The mythology of United 93 that I think most people have is the idea that the passengers at the back of the plane got a dining cart and charged down the center aisle of the plane towards the hijackers. Mm-hmm. Now, we will never know what happened. But I'm absolutely certain, and so is everybody else involved in this film, that that could never have happened. Now, why? Because we had real stewardesses and we were in a real plane with real dining carts. You cannot run a dining cart down the center aisle of an aeroplane.
Right, so they essentially said that could not have happened.
It could not have happened. What you would do if you were tackling a man who you thought would have a bomb is you'd run as fast as you can, because that would take a matter of seconds. Now, do you call that conjecture? I don't. I call that a rational, reasoned attempt to gain the truth in order to replace mythology with something realistic.
I just want to get back quickly to something you said, where you mentioned in working with the families throughout the production and getting the approvals of the families.
Yeah.
Would you have done this film if there were family members who were vigorously opposed to the project?
No, I wouldn't have done it, no.
Why not?
Because they have wisdom that we often miss if we don't listen carefully enough to them. Secondly, I think my work speaks for itself in its unswerving commitment to opposing the use of political violence. But thirdly, this, I think always if you make films in this subject, you must gently and insistently ask the question why.
But do you feel to answer that question properly, you have to have the cooperation of the families.
You cannot make these films. It wouldn't be appropriate. And I have always made, whether it's Bloody Sunday or OMA about the final bombing in Northern Ireland or this film, United 93, worked with all of the families because it gives you an inner strength, and it's the foundation stone of the credibility and the legitimacy of the project.
Given the way that 9/11 has been politicized, are you concerned that some people may perceive this film as a statement as to why America is at war, especially coming at a time when public support for the war in Iraq is in steady decline?
Well, it's not a political statement, this film. Of course, you're right. We're very bitterly divided at the moment in your country and in mine and in Europe and elsewhere. But it seems to me that what this film says is, let's all of us, on whatever side of that divide we are, let's go back to those 2 hours and try and move through them together, collectively in the agreed knowledge that whatever it is we think has happened in the last 5 years and may happen here about which we disagree, we can at least agree, all of us, that it began there. So let's try and pick up the threads and see if there's any lessons that we can learn.
United 93 director and writer Paul Greengrass speaking with Here and Now's Renee Graham. One of those who died on board United 93 was 20-year-old Deora Bodley. 2 days later, her father, Daryl Bodley, wrote this song in her memory. It's called Steps to Peace. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time.